Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I'm here to please remind you, please, to fill out the evaluation for the session. We have a panel of distinguished speakers this afternoon, Teresa Rowe, Jack Seuss, Lois Brooks, Steve DiFilippo. They're going to introduce themselves. Reminder again, please fill out the evaluation.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Steve DiFilippo, Vice President CIO at Cecil College, and I'm here to facilitate this process. So a little bit of housekeeping real quickly. The session will conclude at 2:20, the formal session. There will be a follow-up session with the three panelists right outside in the foyer immediately following the session. Resources associated with this particular session will be available on the EDUCAUSE website for this session and some select social media sites such as Google+. For this session, we're going to use the hashtag EDU13Disrupt. So feel free to participate in any mediated form that will support hashtag searches like Google+ or Twitter. The session is being live streamed. So for participants joining in the Education Online Conference, you'll have the opportunity to participate via your chat session or use the hashtag, as was just mentioned, and this session will be recorded and archived. There are three topical questions that will be presented to the panel. There will be time allotted to ensure that each question is addressed, and then any follow-up questions that may not be answered in the session itself, you can follow up in the foyer in the follow-up session. So let me introduce to my immediate left is Lois Brooks, Vice Provost for Information Sciences and CIO at Oregon State University. Next to Lois is Jack Seuss, Vice President for Information Technology and CIO at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and Teresa Rowe, Chief Information Officer, Oakland University in Michigan. So let's begin. Panelists, as CIOs, what do you think represents opportunities and challenges pertaining to creative disruption, and how is it happening on your campuses? Whoever wants to start.
There are a couple of really interesting things happening at Oregon State University. The first, we're a member of a seven-university state system that is in the process of disbanding itself. We will be pulling out, along with several other universities, to become independent state universities. Simultaneously, we have our major campus in Corvallis, Oregon, and are in the process of growing and redefining campuses in Newport on the coast and in Bend, Oregon, in the center of the state. And so when we look at these three things coming together, we're really talking about a university evolving itself in terms of its programs, what it wants to accomplish, and how it governs and relates to other universities. Tremendous disruption in a positive way, and from what I've heard, perhaps the only system that's going a different direction to really begin to look at its universities separately. Within that, we've got a second area that it's really got me intrigued right now. We're looking, like most universities, at our student experience and the first year experience, but we're looking at this simultaneously across changing the residential programs. We're looking at advising, and we're doing all of this in the context of both the physical and the virtual experience for our students, and in the context of analytics and big data. So really doing a kind of a comprehensive assessment and programmatic change simultaneously across the entire first-year experience. And then the third one I want to mention that's really got me intrigued right at the moment is a little more granular area of disruption, but I think it's going to be one that when we look back we realize is an inflection point for our university. And that is, we are offering, as a state land-grant university, we've got a big distance education outreach program as well as our physical education programs. And we're building on that, and we're offering now a one-year bachelor's degree in computer science fully online. If you've got a bachelor's degree in anything, you can get a second BS in computer science in 1 year from Oregon State University in a comprehensive program. It's obvious who that's geared toward. It was fully subscribed in its first year last year. This year, in our second year, we're looking at a fivefold increase in enrollment over last year. And, you know, as we all talk about change in education models, open education, the future of the academy, this experience to really address a lifelong learner in such a concrete way, I think, is going to be a game changer for us over the long term.
So at UMBC, there's a couple of sort of interesting opportunities that have all come together over the last few years. For many of you, you may have heard of my president, Freeman Hrabowski. He's spoken at EDUCAUSE, I think, back in 2009. Dr. Hrabowski is on the National Academies looking at STEM education. He has been an advisor to the Department of Education. He goes around the country, probably speaks 50 to 70 times a year to various groups, really talking about STEM education. And so what has happened is that UMBC is a campus that 55% of the students, the freshmen, come in planning to major in STEM fields. We're highly STEM as an institution. And we see an opportunity where we can be the model for STEM education in the United States. And one of the interesting things that happened about 3-4 years ago is that we got noted in U.S. News and World Report as one of the top 10 institutions for undergraduate education. And we've consistently been on the list for the last ever since its inception. And what it has done is it has put a focus back to, are we really living what that is that they're saying about us? And so as part of that, Dr. Hrabowski went out and he raised roughly $5 million, and we have started a innovation fund that's around academic innovation in the classroom. And so we are seeing right now at UMBC a redesign of almost all of our core courses going on simultaneously. And so one of the things that has powered this has been a big effort that we have been doing over the last few years in analytics. And so we look very closely at all courses that have what we call high DFW rates. You got a D, you got an F, or you withdrew from the class. And what we're doing is we're really taking a hard look at those classes and going back and trying to understand how we can redesign those courses, how we can introduce active learning, how we can rethink the pedagogy that's going to be there in order to do something different. And as a result, what we have across the board is just a widespread number of courses that are changing. And it has become now the thing, because you can become a Hrabowski Innovation Fellow. So many of the tenured full professors, associate professors, now really are getting engaged with academic innovation, rethinking their classroom, trying to come back and do things differently. And so that's just an incredible opportunity for doing things differently that most people don't get to have. Now, the challenges that come with that, it's all over the map, you know, and so as an IT organization, we are really getting requests coming from all over in terms of, I would like to do, a good example would be, we redesigned our chemistry discovery course for chemistry 101, 102 sequence. In doing that redesign of the lab recitation session, it's a very team-based approach. Students work together throughout the semester. We had to design something that shut off the internet so that they couldn't access anything off campus while they were in the class, because the instructors were afraid that they would go to Facebook or social media or things like this. These kind of special ad hoc requests, which because it's part of a bigger deal, we really have to be, as an IT organization, scrambling to figure out what are the ways that we can do some of these things differently. And so that's the challenge that we're facing right now, is how do we support faculty in an innovative way when we're seeing lots of disparate kinds of approaches across different disciplines.
I think my colleagues talked a little bit here about using analytics to determine program changes in a very exciting way. And it's about using data to have an experience of disruption on your campus. And disruption meaning a change to how we do things every day, right? It's, so this point is being, It's about being creative in that disrupted environment. It's not creative destruction of our educational environments. And there are some articles out there that are suggesting that the next step is really to, you know, go through a process of destruction of our traditions and our ways of delivering education. But there's ways to be doing this in just a disrupted fashion, I think. Disruption comes from a lot of sources. It's the challenge to deliver online in new ways. MOOCs are challenges for us. It's new mandates for showing completion in programs. It's coming up with new degree programs, as Lois described, to address these needs. The challenge for us at Oakland University is to be creative with very limited resources. We're a state school. We've experienced a lot of enrollment growth. We've grown on campus. But at the same time, like so many state institutions, we're seeing less and less support from the state. There's only a limited amount that you can do by through the increase of tuition. So you're trying to find ways to be very creative in a very resource-constrained environment. At my particular campus, we're also going through significant leadership changes. All of our president is new, provost is new, lots of three new deans, new vice president for student affairs, all at the same time. So with an all new leadership strategy, that creates an opportunity. Again, that's very disruptive, but we can learn to be creative with that. So what are we doing? We're really trying to identify those situations where we can showcase faculty in online development. Who are the faculty who are most ready to move to an online environment, and how will we do that? And we're trying to support a faculty member with an experimental MOOC delivery in partnership with another school. Another thing that we are looking at is, it's going to be key for us to retain our students. We are all being challenged to look at outcomes and increase graduation rates. So we've put a lot of effort into systems and technologies that will support our advisors, and maybe even we've disrupted their lives significantly by perhaps putting more systems at their desk than they can handle all at once. But we really need to give them a lot of choices right now on systems and tools so they can figure out which systems and tools are best for them. And one thing we did see was a 7% improvement in our first year retention based on our refocusing in a lot of ways, including technology, on first year advising. So I don't think it's always about having a lot of resources to bring to the table to live through disruptive times, but it's about thinking creatively about what you might do differently to meet those challenges.
Just as a quick...
Can I add one thing onto what Teresa was saying? And it was, I think, you know, one thing that's a takeaway that was really an amazing thing for us was when we started being able to collect enough data out of our LMS system to be able to gauge what are the most active courses that are happening on the campus. And we would rank them within departments. And what would happen is you have no understanding, really. You can see, we did activity. My colleague, John Fritz, who runs the instructional technology group, what he would do is he'd go out and he would find out what's the professor doing. You know, all of a sudden we found a professor in accounting who's doing adaptive release. We found another professor who's doing game-based simulation in a chemical engineering class. We found another professor that's doing team-based learning in a biological science class. You know, a lot of these professors were lecturers. Some were adjuncts. Some were assistant professors. What was interesting was that their colleagues in their department had no idea what they were doing. And so running a brown bag where we focus on game-based technologies in the engineering curriculum, and this assistant professor is up talking about what he's doing in the classroom, and we get other faculty coming in, that's a real opportunity if you can instrument your systems to be able to just find simple things like what are the most active courses and be able to then dig a little deeper into things.
Just real briefly as a follow-up, I find it interesting listening to your individual experiences. As CIOs, and for those of us in the room who are focusing on that role, very little of your response had to do with technology. You really listened to a strategic overlay. Real briefly, does anyone want to kind of speak to that notion? I mean, why weren't you talking about the technologies? Why are we talking about...
It's less about the actual technology than it is about what we're doing with it. And all of these options present opportunities for us to better fulfill the mission that we've been given at our institutions. So when we focus on mission fulfillment and focus on faculty and students and how we teach, we bring the technology in as a tool and a solution, but it's not about the technology.
So where I would say, and for that I'll put a plug in, so one of the articles in EDUCAUSE Review is one that I did with Malcolm Brown, Rob Abel, and we were sort of looking at an architecture for thinking about e-learning, and one of the postulates that we have is that one reason you don't see a lot of innovation, or you see innovation happening outside of central IT, is we are a bit of a problem. How long does it take? If somebody comes to you and say, I want to add a component into our Blackboard course, you know, are you doing it mid-semester? Probably not. If somebody comes in and says, I want a new piece of software that's going to be available for all my students, are you doing it mid-semester, or are you telling them, get this request in 3 months ahead of time so that we can make sure it's in our lab image? You know, we have these constructs that have been bureaucratic, and I think to some extent we've blocked innovation. And so some of the challenges that I'm having to do that's disruptive is disrupt my own staff. It's get us out of the way so that we can be helping to support innovation within the faculty and be able to do new things.
I would also add, there is innovation in technology, of course, but it's more interesting and more strategic for us not to think about the technology itself, but how we're deploying it, how we're using it, what choices we're making within the technology space. And I also think one of our later questions is what should we be working on, and we may talk a little more tech then.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. So are there leadership, political, or organizational challenges that are particularly difficult to navigate for you each?
Piece of cake.
Go ahead.
I'll go first. Yes. The biggest challenge is, for me, is the fact that faculty care passionately about what they do. And they want to do it, at least my faculty, and they want to do it very, very well. And so for them, this is a big commitment when they're going into a classroom and they're going to be changing out, they're going to be leveraging technology, they're going to be doing things differently. They sometimes are feeling like they're the ones who are at risk from a reputational standpoint. And so making sure that I can give them as much support and as much of a safety net as possible to be able to have that kind, take that kind of risk is something that I think is important in terms of managing these things. The other thing that I would say is that there is a real challenge in that a lot of these discussions, because we haven't talked about technology, you know, often people will say, well, this isn't about technology. And it probably isn't, but at the end of the day, the success or failure is going to depend on technology. And if you bring technology in at the end of the discussion with, well, this is the way we're going to do it, just go implement it, you're often left with a higher probability of failure because that solution is not going to be as scalable, it's not going to be as robust. And so a big part of my challenge is how do I politely interject myself
into conversations earlier in the discussion so that I can be trying to influence direction so that it's less of a risk, that it's able to be done more effectively by my group. And so that political dynamic is really always the challenge that I find at my institution.
You know, I spoke earlier about the fact that we're building, expanding two sites in other parts of the state, and we're not trying to create a mini-me experience based on our main campus, really trying to do something that's unique and different and builds on the strengths of those geographical areas of the science and the program capability we've got there. And But we don't have the luxury to do it wrong the first time around. You know, think about what you would do if you were really building two new colleges right now. And so there's incredible challenge in this to pull people out of historic thinking, not on the academic side because they're doing a great job, but on the technology delivery side, on the programmatic, on the business process side, and think, how do you really reinvent yourself as an educational institution in this time? I heard an earlier talk today that focused some on reducing the cost of administration at the university. This is certainly a challenge we face, and doing the hard work to recreate that while we're in the middle of a lot of political disruption is going to be really quite challenging. The other thing I'd add in, two other things on this. One is that we have got to pick up the pace of change. We cannot continue to work and invent and deploy at the same pace that we have in the past, that our academic programs and certainly the world of technology are growing by dog years ahead of us at this point. And the other is an interesting question about the culture of a college campus where academic differentiation and academic freedom matter tremendously for who we are. But there's a challenge for us in the academy when we choose to differentiate and to argue about the right things and the meaningful things rather than differentiating just to create your own silo and your own empire. And I think, you know, Jack talks about interjecting himself in the conversation. I think that's part of it, but I think part of it is just leading the way to say it's okay to differentiate yourself academically, but perhaps not differentiate yourself with your business processes or with other academic processes that then allow us to get more of our time and attention and focus back to the students where it matters and less on focusing internally on ourselves.
I'll bring a little bit of a different perspective. For me, the political and organizational challenges are within and trying to create the technology organization that is going to move with agility as it tries to support disruption and disruptive activities that are bound to occur. It's an ongoing struggle politically and organizationally to have an organization that's that agile. A big obstacle is our HR processes, and while I find the universities willing to change and IT organizations willing to change, when I walk over to the HR department and say, here's how I want to change, that can be an enormous obstacle in the process. I can't keep a traditional an HR organization happy in this kind of world. It's disconnect with where we're going as a university. I also find that one of a role that I need to play is cultural interpreter. The culture is shifting, it's changing, and our faculty who are very focused on their research and in their class, they see these changes around them and they're not quite sure how it impacts them. How is it changing the culture? And if you think about culture, it's how we talk to each other, what we value, what words we use to describe things. Are we using common terminology? So when we start talking MOOCs, do our faculty really understand what that means? Or what is the process by which we make a decision to engage in new disruptive activities? We partnered this summer on the CIO list. CIOs across the country contributed to the development of 50 or so questions that a campus needs to ask and answer, hopefully, as they look at MOOCs and online development. And trying to look at those questions and the impact on the culture of our campus and then interpreting that cultural shift for people who aren't living and breathing technology all day long. I think that's a role that I need to play, and I actively try to insert myself in the process as you described, Jack.
I just would add one thing that was interesting in the discussion, and it's been a unique sort of thing of UMBC, and that was when we did the Chem Discovery Center, it was done under an NSF grant, and it was a four-year grant. And what it's now the dean of that college was the original PI. But what he says is if it would have been a one-year effort, he would have listed it as a failure, because after 1 year, they saw no difference in the way teaching with active learning or teaching the old way they did it. And then, but because it was a four-year grant, they kept trying. And by year three, they were seeing much greater differentiation than what they had seen in year two. And by year four, they were seeing even a continuation above year three. And it was the fact that what he now says and talks about to the rest of the campus is you can't just evaluate these things in a 1 year. You know, we did X, let's evaluate it next year. Okay, it worked or it didn't work. You've got to give some of these things a little bit more time. And that's been a cultural factor that we have sort of accepted a little bit more than I think some campuses. Mm-hmm.
So one of the common threads that I heard all of you say was that you're immersing yourself or interjecting yourself into the process, the political process, if you will, or the organizational process of decision making. So specifically, are there tangible or actionable items, that something you can speak to that's very specific how you do that? So one of the constant conversations across this organization, especially among CIOs, is the role of the CIO. And how do you do that? As you talk to individuals who aspire to be a CIO, sometimes I think I hear them struggle with, well, we understand how to get from point A to point B, but what are some of the tangible things you have each done to immerse yourself in the process or interject yourself in the process or be perceived as part of the process?
It's a great question. Just to start the conversation, I would say that I need to know everybody's stories. I need to be able to tell the story of what's happening on my campus in terms of improved education or growth to the IT staff and help them understand that story. I need to understand the technology story and how it can improve education and be able to explain that to faculty. I need to understand the money story and be able to explain that to the community when we justify why we need to make investments or talk about why we might sunset something so we can turn our resources around. So you've really got to know the entire landscape and then be able to inject yourself as a prism into that landscape to whichever audience you happen to be working with.
Yeah, I was going to build on what Lois has said, and that is I think the unique perspective that IT leaders have is we touch everything. And so I'm working with key faculty who are on the ground teaching, but I'm also interacting with the deans, the provost, the president, and others at the senior levels. And part of what I'm helping to do is to understand conversations that are happening and be the kind of person that, okay, this is an area of focus that I'm hearing at an institutional level. I can be helping at a lower level by, you know, donating some staff resource, donating some funding, doing other things that sort of are that enabler to get something going at a bottom up. And so, you know, for me, what a lot of this is about is understanding, you know, what are our strategic goals, how to help align things properly, but it's also sort of betting on faculty and helping them as much as possible be successful. And so I don't think that, at least my institution, is not a top-down institution. And so there is a strategy, but what I've got to be able to do is work across a lot of different layers of the organization in order to be able to enable things.
I think some of us really struggle on our campuses in getting the attention of senior leadership. I hear it a lot from CIOs. I've certainly experienced it. And it can be very, very discouraging for us. And we say, well, you know, I tried, and they didn't. And I would suggest that we have to persevere. I think I persevere regardless. I don't wait to be asked. I proactively go out and meet with people. I try to identify the faculty that are doing innovative things and talk to them. I insert myself in meetings. If I hear about something, I write to those people or visit those people. But this is not an area where you can sit back as the disruption is happening or new things happen and wait to be asked to be involved. you have to go to them and reach out to them and find a way where you add value to the discussion.
So I think this is why analytics are so important. I mean, bringing data to the table really is helpful in starting a conversation. And there was an example where we've just redone our linear algebra course. There was a pilot, and that it went to a team-based learning model versus the standard lecture. And the DFW rate dropped dramatically, whereas it used to be 40-45%, it dropped down below 10%. And that was just like mind-boggling that, you know, the kids are teaching each other how to do linear algebra, they're working together. That kind of thing, taking that, seeing that data, being able to take that back up to the dean, to the chair, to the president. You know, the president then writes something, wow, this is incredible, can you tell me what you're doing, you know. Those kinds of things are where I can help shine light, you know, and then it becomes a positive reinforcing cycle that's happening within the campus.
Can I just add to that? Because you must then, Jack, you talked about needing 3 or 4 years to know that your program was a success. And you must be also looking at that data and analyze where you continue to make internal bets.
Well, yeah, every year we look at the classes to see how we're doing. There are, and we have a big project going on right now where that's, again, funded by the NSF, where we're looking at lots of different ways of doing interceding in student success. But we randomize the students into 4 different so-called treatments. And so we're looking at the efficacy of these things. And so each year there's a report that comes out about how these things are doing. So it's kind of an interesting thing where the culture is becoming more data-driven.
So in the course of your responses, I've heard a couple of threads, agility, quick to respond. How do you navigate or negotiate creative disruption, which by its very nature is not linear per se, there's a little bit of ambiguity thrown in there, some of the uncertainty and unknown, against a strategic plan that typically is a 3 or 5 year effort?
I'll start that.
So essentially I'm asking, how do you creatively disrupt your strategy?
Right. We have ended planning cycles on our strategic plan. We no longer have a stated 3-year or 5-year plan. This past year, we moved to what we're calling an evergreen plan, and every year we are, and in fact, sometimes more often, we are updating the items in our plan to keep it fresh, to keep it green, to keep it current. We found that even planning out 3 years locked us into things that removed our ability to be agile in the moment and to be responsive. We keep our commitments, and that is incredibly important in this model. We do, if we have a commitment, we make sure we keep that commitment. But the planning cycle is no more. It's ongoing, evergreen.
I would say in our environment, it has been really, it's doing what I think a lot of you are doing, but it's really about taking virtualization, cloud services, and thinking differently about the whole way that we do things. And so UMBC, for those that don't know, I with Lois, I have been a passionate person for In Common. I'll put my plug in for In Common, that I think what we're doing with cloud services, I've been very engaged in Net Plus activities that Internet 2 is doing. We think that this is really key for mid-sized universities, that I don't have 600 people. I have less than 100 people. And so if I'm going to be able to move quickly, I've got to be able to leverage these kinds of cloud services, these kinds of environments. And so we are making a big bet internally on how to be reorienting ourselves to be extremely agile on different activities.
I would agree, and I'll just add couple things. One is that we're watching what Jack is doing to see what works and what doesn't work, because he's going really fast. You know, we all talk to each other. We all know what we're doing, but he's got some really interesting prototypes underway in terms of innovative ways to use cloud services, and we're glad to let you go first.
Yeah.
And we might go second. The couple other things to throw into this. One is that we have got to nail our technology foundation, get it working, get it right. turn our attention less on the mechanics of running an IT shop, really be able to make sure that the core pieces work and get more of our attention back to the innovative areas. A lot of work underway in our university right now around processes, around nailing down some of the technology areas, just hardening systems, moving to virtualization, more monitoring, more automation, all of those things that you're all doing as well. And then within that, continually test the edge, try new things, not in a heavy way, but in a light way, so that when we need to be agile, we've got a pretty good sense of which way to go and be able to go there quickly. I'll pause there and see if you guys want to keep jumping in.
No.
I do definitely agree that the whole concept of right sourcing is critical. Your sourcing decisions really contribute to your ability to be agile.
The one thing I would say is the interesting thing about the creative disruption, which has been the MOOC question. And so as we've looked at the MOOC question, you know, we felt that what it offered us is an opportunity to say, do we want to do this? And what do we also want to be known for? And so as we've had the conversation, we are going to do online programs, but what we're thinking is frankly, we don't want to compete at the end scale, but we want to be known as the place that is going to do this the most innovative way, that it is going to have leverage technology to the hilt in a way that really replicates the in-person experience as much as possible. And so we're sort of taking a little bit of a different tack as we think about where our brand is and what we want to be known for in some of these activities.
Good. So we have just a few minutes left before we open it up to questions, and we leave enough time for that. So any final one brief thought from each of you pertaining to your personal philosophy around innovation and disruption, culture, you know, a culture of innovation or disruption on your campus? Any final kind of closing thoughts?
So I have one that I'll throw out, and then you can. Okay. So mine that I would be is there are lots of times where I think I should have been involved sooner, and I'm not, and that's okay. You can't let it get you upset. And there are some people who feel like I wasn't involved, and I'm never. I look at higher ed over a long period of time. There will be some things I'm going to be involved from the very beginning. There are other things I'm going to be pulled in at a later date. You just have to realize that happens across the whole university. It isn't necessarily a knock on IT. It's just that the way universities function. And I think sometimes we can get too wrapped up in that we weren't invited at the beginning, but then it's figuring out how you make a contribution.
A different direction with this. The work that we've done collectively in our community through Internet 2, the Kowali Project, Sakai, In Common, the HathiTrust, these areas where we've banded together in our universities and really worked together to create value in a way that matters to us, that supports our common mission, is innovative, it's disruptive, it's creative. And I think the trajectory you're going to see going forward is more of this, whether it's open source software, whether it's more consortial work, but really understanding where we need to collectively not just follow around behind each other doing the same thing that somebody else has done, but really band together and do something with our collective resources the right way for the common good, for common social good, for the common good of higher education. I think that the message for me coming out of these discussions in this conference is that the right path forward for my university will increasingly be in partnership with higher education, with industry partners, to create new kinds of business models, new kinds of innovation models.
Let me see if I can talk here. The philosophy that I'd like to emphasize is one of enthusiastically embracing change. This is an enormous opportunity for us to invent things, look at things in a fresh way, bring new perspectives, and it's our attitude. What do we want to bring to the table? If we demonstrate fear, the FUD factor, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, that's the message we're giving our campuses, that these changes are overwhelming. That's not the message that I want to give. I want to give out a message that I find this entire environment exciting. I want to be part of it. I think there's tremendous opportunity for us to fulfill our mission, particularly as a state university, and tremendous opportunity to enable our faculty to, you know, deliver education in new and exciting ways. So all of this is good. Good for our students, good for our faculty, and I'm an enthusiastic embracer of this change environment.
Great, thank you. These are exciting times for sure. So I want to thank our panelists for their insightful comments and conversation. We can open it up to questions. I don't know if there are any questions coming from the online community. Anyone who here is present in the audience, please come up to a microphone because this is being broadcast. We want to make sure that your questions are heard throughout the universe, if you will. So come on up. So there were some really good comments here. I think this one's coming from offline.
Yeah, hi, online, I'm moderator for the online audience. So I have two questions from the online audience. One was, how do you engage students in the creative disruption in terms of feedback and maybe collaboration? And then the other one was, how are you engaging faculty in the creative disruption? Are you offering maybe grants or anything special for them?
So the student one, I'll answer first, which is interesting, and that is that we almost consistently find students hate active learning. It's active. They can't sit in the lecture hall and be passive. And so, you know, when you ask students, you know, do you like active learning, they'll come back, oh, I don't like this as much as the bland lecture. And so some of the question that sits there is, you can't always listen to students on some of those kinds of evaluations. You have to use the data. The adaptive release example in accounting is one. Students feel they're doing so much more work than the other classes because they can only go to the next section until they pass something. They forget at the end of the semester they pass a common final by more than 20% higher than students in the other sections. These are some of the kinds of things where, again, you've got to bring outcome data back to some of the things that we're hearing from students. On the other side, though, you know, what we are finding is that team-based learning, peer learning, is really a critical resource. Engaging students. So one of our models is we have this Meyerhoff Scholars Program. This uses students that are sophomores and juniors to mentor freshmen. That is so powerful, where students who have gone through the class are working as mentors, tutors for other students to help them get A's and B's. That kind of activity is where we're really trying to engage students, is around the peer mentor model.
I think a completely different direction with this. I've been thinking lately about citizen authoring. And if you think about, all of us are trying to get more mobile things out. And the role of the students and some faculty, but mostly the students, in really being citizen developers and authors and contributing to the collective body of tools and technology available to each other on our campuses, and the role of the IT shop shifting from being a programming house into one that enables people to contribute effectively and redistribute their technology. I think we're just starting to pull the thread on this at OSU, and I expect it's going to allow us to move much more quickly and in ways that better align with what students want, because we're actually letting them define their own environments.
Just one thing that I would add to that picture is we've been using and participating in the EDUCAUSE student survey and how they perceive technologies and how they use technologies and what they prefer. And that gives us a lot of insights and just talking to them, really, and working through advisors as well, so that advisors give us a perspective, so that we're linking our technology initiatives to what the advisors say are benefiting students.
Any comments about faculty involvement?
You know, faculty involvement, it's relationship building, and from my perspective, working closely with our Faculty Senate Academic Computing Committee, but also, you know, working with faculty where you've developed relationships. I've friended a few faculty members in Facebook because they tend to talk on Facebook about what they're doing with technology or what they were testing out, and I was finding out more from their Facebook posts than what I was in meetings.
We've just finished the design for a new classroom building on our campus that will have 2,500 formal learning seats across 16 classrooms, 640 informal learning seats. And we worked through this with faculty and students in a nearly a year-long, rich, engaged conversation around what do they want to accomplish with teaching, what do they want to accomplish with learning. It was really kind of a showpiece in community development, community conversation. The outcome is we're going to have a fantastic space that's full of active learning spaces, technology enhanced, really spaces that will feel good to be in, will be kind of comfortable and inspiring to be in. And I think instead of just doing kind of the typical survey that we do or going to our usual suspect faculty, really created an environment where people had a way to quickly give their input, and then we gave them immediate feedback so they could see how their input mattered to the next iteration of the design process, really built a conversation that we wanted to have. We had hundreds of faculty participating in this. I'm not sure that we have any ideas that everyone else in the room hasn't already had, but I mention this because as much as we rely on technology and want to build virtual communities, I think that as humans we really want to get in a room and talk with each other too, and that we can't let that go.
Great. Yeah,
I would just add on our campus, we share space with our Faculty Development Center. And, you know, it's interesting that what we have started on the campus, it was about a decade ago, is really working with all new faculty very, very closely as they start to come on campus and thinking about their instructional goals, the goals for courses. Faculty will work very closely with the Faculty Development Center, who then are handing them off to us, and it's a partnership around how to achieve their goals with the technology in some ways. And so that kind of method, I think, really is helpful.
I would add, too, one thing to consider is partnering with local institutions to have a technology showcase conference. Our e-learning and teaching and learning areas have partnered with the University of Windsor to have a conference that goes back and forth every year, and that is a great way to showcase faculty efforts.
Great. Any questions from the audience? No one's up with the microphone? I'd like to thank the panel. Oh, there's one.
Since we are talking about creative destruction in teaching and learning, could you tell in each of your instances how mobile is playing a role in that in the classrooms?
In the classroom, that's
tough. Playing a role in this
place? You know, that's a tough question. You know, the challenge that we're trying to do, to accept, is to think mobile first. So how can you do everything that you need to do, but do it mobile first? Mobile isn't the add-on, mobile first. And we're just at the start of thinking that way. And I think that's the culture shift that really has to happen.
I'd say for us, I mean, that ship sailed. Not that we've certainly mastered everything we do with mobile, not even close, but our students are traveling with athletic teams and sitting in the quad and doing field research from treetops and ocean-going vessels, and our faculty are mobile, and the notion that anybody is going to park their body at a desk in Corvallis and that's their entire work environment is long since gone, and I think that we embrace it. We're playing catch-up behind where our community has already voted with their feet long since.
Yeah, I would say my campus, it's probably a little more mixed in the sense that we've done a major push on wireless, and it's ubiquitous, and we have just upgraded, and we have a lot of our learning management system has got mobile enablement, and we've got mobile enablement for a lot of other functionality. But at the same time, we have courses where you're not allowed to bring out your phone. In some of the lectures that they're doing, bringing out your phone, sort of gets you your hand slapped. And the second time, you have to put it in a basket when you come into the lecture hall. And so we're seeing this dichotomy that is sort of happening that's there. And I think that what we expect to happen is we make heavy use of the clicker model. We went to that 6-7 years ago. It's used quite heavily to do pop quizzes and lectures and things like that. We're seeing this evolution where students no longer are going to be buying the clickers, and it's going to switch over to phones, and we're going to be doing this. But a lot of it is going to also need to be space redesign. And I think we're still struggling. The way we deal with lectures is been that most of them are getting cut down into classes that might be 80 to 90 in size, and then we're doing active learning. But we still have a few large sections where we have to do lectures, and that's where they use clickers and those sorts of things. But I don't think we've developed a really great mobile strategy yet at this point in time.
Great. Time is up. Thank you very much. It was a very active and lively and interesting and insightful conversation. Teresa, Jack, and Lois will be out in the hallway for the next half hour when we conclude here. And thank you, everyone.